can become part of a permanent record and can be made available to the public.
This meeting is being recorded.
We don't know who that voice is.
That was that's the automatic Zoom voice.
Oh, okay. So, with the idea that this could become a part of the archives, if we can make this happen. Okay, well, Karen's just a symbol now.
Yes.
But she's going to be able to chime in as she sees fit as we proceed here. But I guess we'll start by saying thank you very much for taking time to do this and for working through the technical part of getting it set up. I thought the first item we should start with is the Goldstream Valley and settling in the Goldstream Valley. And if you talk a little bit about that, that'll get us situated in Fairbanks, and then we'll go on to Minchumina.
Bill, would you like to do an intro to the interview about where we are and who we are?
Oh, that's right. I only did this for 30-some-odd years. So, Karen, why don't you do it, since you're the authority now.
Today is November 20th, 2020. And we are here today with Richard Dick Bishop and Mary Bishop. And this is Karen Brewster and also Bill Schneider doing the interview. And we are also joined by Tom Paragai and Roger Kay, who will be listening and or chiming in with questions of their own. And I guess we're going to talk about the Bishop's history in Fairbanks and their involvement with conservation and wildlife issues and subsistence. So thank you to everybody for joining in, and take it away, Bill.
Thank you, Karen. Let's talk about the Goldstream Valley and developing a homestead.
Okay, just a super short, brief background. We came to Alaska in 1961. We had both come from hunting and fishing and Richard trapping backgrounds in Minnesota and Wisconsin. We met at the University of Minnesota. We came in 1961 with a rather eventful and slow trip, pulling a house trailer at the first snowfall. And then in 1966, we moved to a homestead. We purchased a homestead from Frank Day, who was the original homesteader in the Goldstream area, in the hills north of Goldstream. And moved there with three toddlers, Dan, Sam, and Doug, and it was a very sketchy house with about 2 inches of mouse-eaten insulation. And we heated with wood and coal the first year because we moved in September and didn't have enough time to cut the wood, adequate amount. We have some very interesting stories about hauling coal from the coal bunkers, which was a neat historic place in Fairbanks, and lived there without power or water until we moved to McGrath in 1969, January of 1969, when it was about 50 below with our sled dogs. And so from there, Richard.
Well, go ahead, Bill. Take it from there. It was Goldstream or whatever.
Was you had written down Gus's Grind? Was that where the homestead was?
It is, yes, and that name came about long after the homestead. It's named after Gus Lamprecht, who is a nearby homesteader, and it came about because the post office said you have to have a street address, even if it's not a real road, or you won't get any mail. So he thought about it and said, all right, the reason it's here is because Gus had some land back here and there was a power line We'll name it after Gus. That is a terrible trail. It's not really a road. What do we name it? Gus's Grind. And it's been that ever since.
Yeah.
Oh, that's neat. I had a chance to go out there to the Sutton's place the other week, and I can testify to the fact that it's quite a road.
Oh, it's much better now. Unbelievably much better now than it was.
Yes, people who were here years ago, and they come back and come in and we say, have you noticed how much better the road is? And they kind of give us a cold stare and say, no.
So were you working for Fish and Game at that time?
No, when we moved up here, I applied for graduate school at the University in Wildlife Management. I had completed my bachelor's. Mary had completed her master's in zoology. And I was in a postgraduate program for a while and then got into graduate school the following year in 62. So I went up there and started taking classes and working part-time and getting things in order. And in 1962, I'll stick this in because it didn't really come up anywhere else. We were still living in the college area, and of course we were broke. By then we had rented a small cabin from Claude and Susie Swaim at the base of the University Hill, and had a job opportunity, which was to go to gamble on St. Lawrence Island and monitor the walrus harvest, which the state had just begun management of, being pretty new, and collect specimens there. So I was there a couple months. So that was my first exposure to rural Alaska in 1962. I was new to oceans, so I was from Minnesota. Hadn't seen one, well, I'd seen one before. So I went and tasted it just to make sure I was on the seacoast.
It was salty?
It was salty. It was the real thing.
McCoy. Yeah, so after that, then you went back, and that's when you established the homestead?
The homestead had been proved up by our friend Frank Day. Mm-hmm. He had decided to go back to New England where his roots were, and along about 65 or so, we asked him if he was interested in selling it because we were looking for a place to live and really liked it here. And we'd helped him with the place some in the course of time, over time he was here. He said yes. And so we struck a deal and we bought the homestead, which was a very small thing as homesteads go. It had the shell of the cabin that Mary described, and 33 acres, roughly. It worked out nicely for us, even though it was kind of challenging in terms of access and power initially.
Putting the Coleman stove under the car to get the car to heat up enough to go to work when it's 50 below.
Yeah.
All those things you're not supposed to do.
Yeah. So then you went out to McGrath area. Was that an assignment from Fish and Game?
It was an assignment, yes. I went to work for Fish and Game in 1965 as a temporary, and a year or so later became a permanent employee. And I worked here in the Fairbanks for a time. On moose studies, wool studies, and whatever else came into the back lab that needed measuring, gutting, weighing, and all the rest of that. And eventually an opening came. Actually, it was the first of several area biologist positions to be established by Fish and Game in the state. And I applied for the job and was fortunate enough to get it. It's the first time there was an area biologist there. Prior to that, there had been a conservation officer, which was kind of a combination biological technician and enforcement person. So we stayed there until 1971. So almost 3 years.
So that was in McGrath, where you were the area biologist?
That's correct.
And that's where Richard ran across. He did beaver sealing, and he found, he went to this place where we moved to at Minchuminock.
Yeah, I had a really big territory that I never really was able to cover, but part of it was Lake Minchumina, and that was how we established a connection with Lake Minchumina. It was through beaver sealing, getting acquainted with people there. And I should add that one of my motivations for coming to Alaska had always been, since I was a teenager, was to trap in the North Woods. And as time went on, Alaska seemed to be the logical choice to try to do that. And so that was behind a lot of my motivation for moving here. I had been up here in 1959 for the summer and worked as a fish counter for the Fish and Wildlife Service in Bristol Bay, and also as a trail digger in McKinley Park. Then I went back to Minnesota to finish school, and Mary and I met in school and got together and turned around and headed north again.
Yeah. But in the McGrath area, what were some of the issues you were addressing as a fish and game agent there?
One of them was part of a later subject on the list, and that's predation and predator control or predator management. Another
guide Nikolai connection and guiding.
Oh yeah, there was some interest in the village of Nikolai among some of the men there in getting into the guiding business, qualifying as registered guides. So I spent quite a bit of time working with them to get them acquainted with what was required of registered guides and so on, and administering along with another guy from Fish and Game, who by then was, I think, in Southeast, Don Cornelius. And after a lot of advice and instruction, we conducted the tests for three men from there, and we conducted them orally. They had difficulty with the English language, so we did it orally, and they all passed. Only one of them actually wound up being active as a registered guide. I think the other two did some guiding as assistants. So that was an issue. Another issue was, I mentioned predation. Another was beaver management. Beaver were a pretty important resource, and in some areas they were, the numbers had declined. The Hulitna River, for example, near Sleep Mute. And so I made a recommendation that the season be closed for a period of time, which was kind of controversial, because that was a pretty important thing in that area. But after a couple of years, it seemed to have really helped, and then the board opened it again. And so since then, I don't think there's been a real problem. And there was a little bit of kerfluffle about guiding operations by registered guides who took out clients for big game hunting.
You did a lot of moose survey work too, didn't you?
Yeah, I did some moose survey work, some sheep survey work. There really wasn't much known about it at that time. A little bit on documenting the whereabouts of caribou that came through. Kind of a general inventory and a lot of public relations, I guess you'd say. Getting acquainted is probably a better term, with local folks in not only McGrath, but Nikolai, Tulida, Sleep Mute, and
Takotna
and my area actually extended all the way to the Bering Sea, so I did get to Bethel and Old Shivak with Cal Lensing and a couple other places. I also got involved in the very first muskox transplant from Nunavak Island to the mainland, Nelson Island on the mainland. It consisted of 8 calves. It was a real rodeo. No tranquilizers, thank you. They were stuffed in a little 2-engine plane called a bamboo bomber, 2 at a time, and flown to Nelson Island. And it worked out. Then there were later transplants also that improved on the technique. So there are muskox there. They thrived, and they're still doing fine as far as I know.
From 8?
Yeah, well, no, there was later ones that added to the numbers.
Were you involved in when they transplanted them up to the Arctic Wildlife Range?
Not directly, no. I just gave some free advice. One of the funny incidents about that was that the National Guard agreed to move them from Nunavak to the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, Arctic Wildlife Range at that time. And they did so. I don't remember the numbers. It wasn't a huge number. But the guard had a real complaint. It was a long trip, and the muskox had nowhere to go to the bathroom except in the plane.
Big bladders.
And when they got done with the transplant, the plane was not well appointed inside. But it was successful.
Do you remember the names?
As were some others.
Do you remember the names of those guides in Nikolai who took the test?
Mm-hmm. Yes, one was Philip Esai, and he was the guy who actually did some guiding. He actually guided a friend of mine for Doll Sheep.
A Dennis? Oh.
I have to think about it a little bit. It should come back. Let's see. No, anyway, let's go on. I'll probably
we'll go
come
on.
Up with it.
Okay.
It's interesting that Nikolai, when we did interviews in the Nikolai area, people talked about guiding, and it was unusual to me to hear about Native people getting involved in guiding. Of course, later we learned that was more widespread than we thought, but that's one of the things that came out there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then let's talk about Minchumina. So you had contact with Minchumina as your responsibilities for fish and game.
Bill, can I interrupt for a second before you go? Tom has written a question in the chat that relates to Nikolai. So,
okay.
And plains bison. So, Tom, do you want to just go ahead and ask that question out loud? Because otherwise we don't
get
it recorded.
The plains bison were transplanted out to Farewell in 1965, and I was just curious if you were involved in any surveys for them at that time. They were probably pretty a small herd yet. And I just wanted to make a comment. There are still some guides for bison based out of Nikolai today. That's been a fairly successful operation for them over the years to guide the few people that draw those permits.
Yes. Actually, I was involved on the export end of the transplant in Delta Junction when those were captured and boxed up and sent to Farewell. I wasn't on the Farewell end at that time. But I did, while I was in McGrath, I did monitor the bison herd. And it remained at a very small number for many, many years. I think it capped out at no more than about 150. I'm not sure I remember the exact numbers right. Until the Bear Creek fire occurred perhaps a couple decades later, and created a lot of new grassland, and then the population really took off. One of the interesting things about the Delta, the they're on the South Fork of the Kuskokwim called the Farewell Herd. One of the interesting things was that there didn't seem to be any significant predation on them by anything for quite a long time, I'd say 20 years or more. It was like the wolves and bears just hadn't figured out how to catch them.
Hmm. Well, that's curious.
Yeah.
So I wanted to get back to Minchumina, if we can at this point. So you had contact there as your responsibilities with Fish and Game. But then how did this contract work out with CPSU and the subsistence study?
Oh, well, that came along much later. After...
Were you living in Minchumina at that time that it took place? Or?
What happened was that I left the job in McGrath and we moved back to Fairbanks in 1971.
Okay.
And I took a different job with ADF&G in Fairbanks. We still were interested in... kind of had a serious itch to participate in a subsistence lifestyle in some fashion. And so we had been, while we were in McGrath, we'd been looking around at areas that if opportunity permitted, maybe we would move to, if possible, and fish hunt and trap and see how that went. And so when we got acquainted with the folks in Minchumina, and the people who were instrumental became our friends. It was Tom and Mary Flood. They had been residents there for quite some time. They trapped and did a little commercial fishing, which didn't really work out. And interesting contrast in interests. Tom was an avid participant in the stock market. It was quite a contrast to being, you know, a hardcore trapper with dogs and snow machine eventually. And Mary was a native lady from Holy Cross of mixed Russian and Yupik ancestry. They met in Fairbanks and eventually moved to Cordova and then to Lake Minchumina, and that was the home till in their turn each passed away. So they said, okay, you can use our old cabin. We've moved, we built a new cabin closer to the runway. Their old cabin was at the east end of the lake, just across that part of the lake from the Collins residence where Dick and Florence Collins and their kids, Mickey, Julie, and
Ray,
and Ray lived initially, and then for a while they were there seasonally because the kids had to go to school in town here. And of course when they got done with all of the schooling, the twins went back to Minchumina and have been there ever since. Ray, meanwhile, has established himself in a variety of enterprises here in town. But that was our connection, and the Floods had an amazing dog team and some really interesting stories about their experience with them. But they were very well trained. We actually, Tom gave us one of them while we were still in McGrath. It was just a super leader, except for the fact Mary took him out regularly while I was working. And the exception was that if he decided it was time to go home, he took the team home, whether Mary was with him or not. And the flight service station would call me and say, Dick, your dog sled's come in again without a pilot. So I'd go out looking, and the whole turn. Several people from town turned out to look for... The dog team came in, we didn't know where Mary was, so we had to go looking.
And they all passed me as I walked into the...
But anyway, village. I guess, yeah. Anyway, getting back to the Montumna situation, I came back to Fairbanks, went back to work for Fish and Game, worked for a while, and meanwhile, this arrangement with the floods evolved, and we decided we would do that, and so I resigned from Fish and Game in 1975. I had the opportunity to teach one semester at the university in wildlife management. That was the beginning of what was intended to be an exchange of staff between the university and ADF&G, and I guess it I must not have done a good job because it did not proceed further. But anyway, after that semester, then that June in 1975, we moved Lock, Stock, and Dog Team to Lake Minchumina and spent the next 2 years there. But, and this ties into what we'll get into later on, I had been very active in the Alaska Conservation Society, and we in the Conservation Society were very concerned with what was developing in preparation for the passage of a bill,
ANILCA.
And so one of the things that caught my attention, because I was familiar with the Minchumina and north side of McKinley area, was that the Park Service, in their environmental assessment or impact statement, had stated that they knew of no subsistence use in that area, so they assumed there were none. There were none of subsistence uses. And I said, well, that's a bunch of baloney. And so I complained about that to different people, and eventually that sort of complaint came up in other places as well. The Cooperative Park Studies Unit was established, and people were hired to do subsistence use studies in several of the proposed park areas. So that's what I did at Minchumina after we moved there. After several months, that opportunity arose, and that led to reporting on what I could glean in the course of a year about local uses of wild renewable resources, and a bit of history.
And
I think I think we should point out that the Alaska Conservation Society, which started in 1960 and was pretty active until about 1980, was Richard's and mine, to some extent, first involvement really in this kind of thing within the state. And Richard was, he was on the board for quite a while, and I think maybe acting president or president for a while. And the ACS position on ANILCA was not, well, I'll let Richard punish you.
Okay. ACS, I got really interested in it because it had a kind of a unique perspective, I thought, that was a fundamental concern with the well-being of the environment. But the concerns were based on significant scientific knowledge. So some of the leading people in the organization were Bob Whedon, who was a biologist. At the time, he worked for Fish and Game. Later, he was at the university. Les Virick, Terry Virick, who were PhDs. Les was a plant ecologist. Terry was a physiologist.
Glenn Jourdain.
Pardon me?
Glenn
Jourdain was a forester who was also a member. Celia Hunter was a very sincere environmentalist. Ginny Wood, similarly. Both good people that I really enjoyed. Didn't always agree with, but I really enjoyed them. So it was a good outfit. And Ed Murphy was a later addition who became president. And during the time that Whedon was president, I can't remember, he got siphoned off somehow or another and wasn't able to function for the society, and I had to fill in. I don't remember. I was a board of directors member. I don't remember how I got the short straw, but I did. And so there was, for about a year, there was a number of things that Tina Stonaroff, the secretary, kept me busy with ACS functions for that period of time. And to the extent, I was busy to the extent that Mary and I started to joke that Tina was the other woman in my life. But she was really good, and it was a really interesting time. But the Alaska Conservation Society differed significantly from the Alaska Coalition, which was the national environmental group that was promoting ANILCA and lobbying heavily for it in Congress, most significantly with regard to hunting. ACS wanted to maintain traditional hunting areas, not just subsistence, but Alaskan hunting by Alaskans. And that didn't sit well with the Alaska Coalition. They had no fundamental interest in allowing hunting, particularly if it was on areas that had been proposed for parklands. One of the first contacts with the Alaska Coalition was with two guys from them. One was, I think, Charlie Callison, at least his last name is Callison. And the other one, I may think of it, was with the Wilderness Society, came to Fairbanks, met with me and Wyatt Gilbert, who was an active AOC member at the time.
AOC, ACS.
I mean, ACS. Hard to keep the initials separate. Anyway, Wyatt Gilbert was a geologist with the State Geological Service. We met with those guys and talked about what our concerns were and perspective that hunting was not a threat to the integrity of those lands and so on, and that we felt that some areas should not be closed to that legitimate use. And Callison, who was kind of a little bulldog kind of guy, finally got fed up and he said, look, if ACS insists on hunting in lands designated parks for parks, then that's where the conversation with the Alaska Conservation ends, period. And we were just shocked. The other fellow was a much more reasonable guy. I can't think of his name again now. Anyway, so ACS offered their input and advice on it. But the crux of the matter was that the Alaska Coalition, which was, again, comprised of major national environmental groups, had no resident Alaska conservation group on its rolls. And they desperately wanted Alaska Conservation Society to be a member. And after a lot of tumultuous debate, ACS finally decided to join and continued to submit its alternate views on what the best arrangements would be. And eventually one member, Rich Gordon, went to Washington to work with the coalition, supposedly to get ACS's input into them. And I don't know that he was successful at all. He was a very good fact finder and probably did a lot of good for them in that regard. But ACS never heard from him again. And as a result of being listed with the Alaska Coalition, ACS's credibility in Alaska was destroyed. And it died around about 1980 as an organization.
Let me back up just a little bit. When you decided to do the subsistence study in Minchumina, what role did ACS and your involvement with ACS have in your wanting to do that study, if any?
ACS was, people in ACS were interested in it. They were interested in, you know, that, not just there either, but in general, because it was more of a statewide issue relating to other places like Wrangell, St. Elias, and Katmai, et cetera, et cetera. So there was some interest in that. They had no direct involvement in it. I was on my own hook with that and no connection with ACS in that circumstance.
Was ACS interested in Minchumina area being added to Denali National Park?
ACS had never proposed it, and I don't remember what their comments on the proposed addition were.
They did support preserves, didn't they, as opposed to park?
ACS in general supported preserves in portions of the areas that had been proposed for to become parklands as a preferable alternative to Hart Park. So, for example, Wrangell, St. Elias is one that came to mind. Parts of Katmai, possibly the south side of Denali, I don't remember now. They did get interested in what I was doing at Minchumina to the extent that eventually Herb Melchior, who was a member of ACS also, and I wrote an article that was in the Alaska Conservation Society Review magazine on the character of subsistence uses, characteristics of subsistence uses and what it involved, and the essence of it was that subsistence uses covered a wide spectrum of uses that of varying degrees of reliance and orientation and tradition and so on. So that was published, and I don't think that ACS was committed to either a native or a rural priority firmly. Mm-hmm. Mary had an interesting experience in Congo. She went there and lobbied with a private group during the time the NILC was going through and met quite a few people. And you met.
Well, who was it? Governor Hammond at the time?
Yes.
Had a group of private citizens went to lobby with regard to the subsistence and to all of Anilka. And I was one of several people that was selected, chosen, applied. I can't remember. Anyway, I went at least once, I think twice. And what I did primarily was I took along copies of Alaska Conservation Society's position paper on subsistence. And that was my main focus of going around to all these senators and congressmen. And somebody set up the meetings for us to go. And I went, I recall going to this one senator's office and handing him the position paper, and he read it and he said, why is ACS a member of the Alaska Coalition? Because it was so obvious from the position paper that there was a lot that ACS did not agree with as far as the coalition is concerned.
ACS supported hunting, and the Alaska Coalition didn't like to talk about. And trapping? Silence. Dead silence. Nobody wanted to bring it up.
And the rural priority, I think, was that was not something that ACS supported. There was a priority at the time. The state had passed a priority for subsistence use, but it was not a rural priority. It was just a priority for subsistence use. And what the coalition or the proposed bill took the state bill and then they added the word rural. I guess there
and
was some...
And some other word.
And it was for all renewable resources. It wasn't right. Just fish and game. It was all renewables, timber, water, whatever. And that's the way it stayed.
So maybe we kind of hop back and forth. Are you back to Minchumina, or where are you? Where are you?
We're going to get into that subsistence priority issue, but I'd like to finish up the discussion about going back to D.C. In your interview with Kathy Harm, you talked about going back to D.C. and working with the feds, and I was under the impression, Dick, that was in preparation for ANILCA, but was it after ANILCA that you did that?
No, it was in preparation for ANILCA. It would have been the 78, 79, in the early part of 1980.
And who sent you back on that?
The State Department of Fish and Game, Governor Hammond, basically.
What were some of the issues that you were addressing with folks back there then?
Well, I think probably the broadest issue was how ANILCA, as it was written at the time, and of course it changed a bit from time to time here and there, affected states' rights to manage fish and game. And at that stage of the game, there really was not much in ANILCA that acknowledged, first of all, did not acknowledge a well-established responsibility of states to manage resident fish and game. It simply was not a part of the consideration. With regard to the subsistence priority, which originally had been proposed by Morris Udall some years before as a native priority, still came up early in the game, maybe before I even got there in 78 or 9. And the alternative rural priority was brought up as a possible, well, basically Hammond told Congress that the state could not, within its constitutional limits, enforce a rural priority.
A native priority.
Because people, advocates of it, anticipated that there was a provision in ANILCA that anticipated once the federal law with regard to the subsistence priority passed, the state would do whatever it needed to do to comply with that provision. And it soon became apparent that that was problematic for the state. So the native priority was dropped, the rural priority was included, and it was not clear initially that it would meet constitutional requirements under Alaska's constitution. And eventually, the state attorney general said, no, it almost certainly will not. But for whatever reason, and I don't know what the reasoning was, the governor acquiesced basically to rural being in the Title VIII of ANILCA when the bill passed. Well, of course, it turned out later that the Alaska Supreme Court found that it did not meet constitutional muster.
That was in the McDowell case.
In the McDowell case in 1989.
So when you were back,
go ahead.
Just a clarification. When you were back in D.C., that was an issue that you were addressing in support of the state's position? Or
yes.
And how did you find the federal people that you talked to? Were they receptive? Do they? What was their angle on it?
Well, you mean the people in Congress or the agencies?
Both.
Yeah. This is a generalization, but people in Congress didn't know what we were talking about.
Yeah.
And, Alaska is a cheap
and most of them didn't really care. They were about the whole issue, in fact. They were focused on more, and this is my interpretation, more on their reputation back home than they were on solving the problems that were raised in Anilka. So that was Congress. It was amazing to me because it was a towering challenge for those of us from Alaska, and it was not of the same stature for most members of Congress. It was something they had to do and had to put up with for political reasons, both the heightened environmental awareness in the public and the country at large, and with regard to the subsistence issue, they had to deal with that with respect to Native Americans and Alaska Natives in particular, because they damn sure didn't want to get into an argument with the Native lobby in Congress, because an argument involving racial overtones was the worst thing a politician can get in.
You know, one of the things that Richard earlier mentioned was making sure that part of his job there was making sure that the state maintained its regulatory authority.
Mm-hmm.
Think about that in terms of the more recent Sturgeon case. It's all coming down from that.
Yeah, the Sturgeon case is a good example of the sort of thing that was raised, you know. How does it impact state management? How in turn does that affect the ability to maintain management on a sustained basis? And ultimately, how does it fit or relate to what the Alaska Constitution says, which is common use and equal protection under that law? So those are the kinds of issues that came up in many respects. And as I mentioned earlier, there was no recognition or acknowledgement of the longstanding tradition and legal status of state management of resident fish and game. That just wasn't a big consideration. So those were things, aside from a lot of stuff on everything like transportation corridors and so on and so forth, there's just a lot of stuff that affected the status of lands and the potential for people's uses of them, all the way from minerals to fishing game management, or even just travel.
Now, what was the agency's response? You said that Congress wasn't very interested, but did the agencies have different responses when you talked to them?
We didn't talk much with them. Some. At least I didn't, but we did interact with them to some extent. But frankly, the federal agencies, by that time, they were in a food fight over seeing who could get the most out of the deal. Every agency wanted a big chunk of Alaska. Initially, even the Forest Service wanted some land in the Arctic, if you can believe that. They finally backed off from that. But that was the reality. There was a huge amount of elbowing and gouging among federal agencies that I was aware of, where they're competing for lands that would fall within their agency's purview as opposed to some other agency's purview. So, and that really created a lot of confusion. They finally kind of sorted out.
We're jumping ahead a little bit in my next question, but it ties in. You mentioned sturgeon and
yes.
The sturgeon case, and I'm not sure I understand how that may relate to navigable waters, but how does it relate to the issue of the common use provisions of the Constitution?
I'm trying to think how to rope the stray strands in. But if you think about, I'll start with the Katie John case that went on. And yes. the issue there was whether there was a responsibility of the federal government to provide for the rural subsistence priority on the Copper River so that Katie John and others could fish there. That ties in to the sturgeon case in this way. The Copper River is a navigable waterway that BLM has recognized, and that involves, to be navigable, that involves agreement between the state and BLM. The Nation River, where sturgeon was, is also a navigable waterway, which he knew, and he knew the law well enough to question the National Park Service authority to regulate uses of that river. In the Nilkin, Title 8, Section 103C, I believe it is, it says that the federal government has authority over lands which are federal public lands. I'm paraphrasing. Navigable waters are not federal public lands. As a matter of fact, a lawyer who knows Anelka infinitely better than I do, and federal law in general, all laws in general, said there are no federal waters in Alaska, no federal navigable waters in Alaska. The federal government does not own navigable waters, but states own the submerged bed and have management authority over the resources and the regulation of their uses in state, in that recognized navigable waters. And that's a matter of longstanding law. And enfranchised in the Submerged Lands Act,
yeah.
Alaska Statehood Act. And that's the crux.
Yeah.
So why would a federal agency presume to regulate subsistence uses on a navigable water for which they basically have no authority? And what happened was that advocates of doing so convinced the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to approve the concept of federal reserve water rights, which gave the feds supposedly the right to manage in that fashion, manage subsistence on a navigable stream. Well, that infringed on the state's responsibilities and authorities during the Knowles governorship. And Governor Knowles at the time said, that's an infringement on Alaska's authority and responsibility, and no governor should stand for it. And so he threatened to appeal it to the Supreme Court. There was such a firestorm of political opposition that it wasn't too long before he changed his mind because he intended to run for office again. So it never was. He basically deserted the state in not filing that lawsuit, and so it never came up again in federal court to determine if that Federal Reserve doctrine was legitimate.
So you think it was a political decision on Knowles' part to give up on the case because the public was in support of Katie John?
It was clearly his decision, a political decision, to give up on it, because when he said he was going to pursue it and defend the state's rights and authorities, AFN and other Native interest groups came out like thunder and lightning and said, if you do, and this is virtually a direct threat, if you do, we are going to go to the wall to defeat you the next time you run for office. We will oppose you, whatever you run for. And that was the strongest expression of either opposition or support that I think I've ever seen in public in a political issue. It was a dire threat. There's no question about it. And he believed it, and he was right. They would have taken him out.
Well, is this a good time for us to talk about the rural subsistence priority? Are we in the right order here?
Might be a matter of perspective.
You might make that quote just as an entry.
I'm going to just one first. I just want to quickly interrupt with Mary and Dick. Is there a way you can position your camera a little better, or Dick, get closer? I'm only getting about half of Dick's face in the video.
Yeah, Richard, can you see that? They want you better.
Yeah, I see that. Let me get something over here.
Okay. Yeah, Mary, you pop in, and then that's fine. But, yeah, we're sort of only getting part of Dick's face, and it would be nice to see all of him.
Let me get a taller pulpit.
So, whatever.
And Karen, are we following the sequence properly here?
I don't know. I haven't really been keeping track.
Okay.
There are certainly things we could go back to with more detailed questions if we want, and...
Okay.
Tom and Roger may have things they want to chime in on, too, but let's just keep going with the flow.
Yeah, let's jump into the subsistence priority.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. It ties in. So is Dick getting his bully pulpit?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Mary,
I'm not sure I like that inference, Karen. Bully pulpit.
Mary, you have to understand that Karen likes to pun.
Oh, well, then Richard is...
I'm in good company, then.
Yeah, good.
Is that going to work or not?
If I move up, probably it will. How's that?
Yeah, that's good.
That's better.
Okay.
And then Mary can elbow me when I need to get out of the way.
Yeah.
Okay, so...
Well, actually, now it's back to you're still the part of your head, but it's your closer part of your head.
Tip the screen back, I think.
It's hard with an iPad to get the angle just right. We had it figured out yesterday, but, you know, people sit in different places. And if it doesn't, it's okay. We have the audio, so that's fine.
Yeah.
That's perfect.
Perfect.
Can you get another book, man?
Get another book?
Yeah. Obviously, an intellectual discussion.
Yes.
Yeah, we're going to sit on it.
Uh, You can go ahead if you like. I can hold it up while she's getting the book.
Okay.
Okay. So let me see if I can figure out the best way to phrase this question. So we have the feds and Title VIII, which are providing a subsistence priority for rural Alaskans on federal land. And we have the state, because of the common use provision, that doesn't permit any priority use for any particular group or individual, that it's a common pool resource that everyone has access to. So what is your position, and how did it develop on that issue?
Well, my position is that the Alaska Constitution is very clear. It says all Alaskans have the opportunity for common use, and not in the same part of the Constitution, but they also have equal protection under the law. When the Alaska Supreme Court heard the McDowell suit, they spent quite a long time on it, and they went through in a wonderfully thorough way the background of the legal background of the management of fish and game in the United States, and they pointed out that the authority under the public trust doctrine went to the states and so on. And when they got done, they said no. A rural priority in law, which had just been put in by amendment to the state law, is unconstitutional because it discriminates in conflict with the Constitution among Alaskans, and it's not acceptable. One of the Supreme Court justices at the time, in his comment with reference to the decision, said, and this is a quote, "It is an equal protection case, and an easy one at that." And he concurred.
That was Moore?
As Justice Moore. There was only one dissent to that decision in the court, which was by Judge Justice Rabinowitz. So that's my view, and it's not necessarily an easy thing to accomplish to provide for subsistence uses, but in fact, prior to the imposition of a rural priority, the state had already been doing it through the Board of Game, through various regulatory means, and has continued to do it. By ways that do not discriminate against people, other Alaskans, to participate in subsistence hunts. They may have to work a little harder to participate, like go to Kaktovik to get a muskox permit, but they darn sure can get a muskox permit, or at least compete for one, if the number is limited, by following the rules. So it's cumbersome. I don't know that there should be even, in all cases, that complicated a system, but it meets the constitutional requirement of equal access and provides common use provisions. I continue to support that view. And
So you don't think there should be an amendment to the state constitution which would provide a rural subsistence preference in times of resource shortage?
I'm glad you said that, Bill. You just
made me choke.
You just brought up one of the most durable myths in the discussion of subsistence. And that is that the federal priority only is enacted in times of shortage. And that is pure, now I'm on the right pulpit, pure BS. The priority in the federal law is in place at all times.
Whenever there are regulations, indicates that there is a shortage. And that has been agreed to by AFN, actually, and as well as state attorney generals. It's all the time, whenever there are regulations.
Yeah. That is a myth. I check it out, but it's not a case of when there's a shortage. The federal priority exists at all times. The restrictions under state regulations will change according to the levels of resource availability. But even that is not keyed. Well, those restrictions are keyed to availability. But the subsistence priority in state law is there also all the time. But the degree to which it's implemented changes with the availability of resources.
We can pretty easily send you actual legal document quotes for all of this.
Good.
The myth of shortage.
You know, one of the most wonderful and humorous comments that somebody made early in the discussion about a rural subsistence priority was made by a mid-level fish and game person that I won't name. And he said, you know, some big bull session discussion of it. Finally, he says, I just don't believe this BS about a subsistence, about a priority for people subsiding in a circumcised area. And he was dead serious. But you know what it expressed? It was a perspective on the level of public understanding, even within the Department of Fish and Game, of what was involved in that priority. But it was very telling. Man, I really had to go like that when I heard it. It would have been very embarrassing.
Well,
anyway.
Let's take it a little bit further, and you can educate me some more on this. If there is a subsistence priority on federal land established under ANILCA Title VIII, and if the state has a subsistence priority, but the way in which the common use provision works is that it can't designate a rural area for a priority, even though
right.
the resource may be endangered in that area. Then how do we reconcile that?
Well, one way, I sort of mentioned it, but I'm not sure I'll get all the details right, but I haven't kept track of exactly how it's working in all cases today. But McGrath comes to mind. Quite a while I was there, there was an awful lot of moose. Eventually the moose numbers changed, and not too many years ago there was a real urgent demand from McGrath for doing something about the levels of predation on moose in particular. The department looked at it and finally decided, yes, that's where the leak is. It's with predation, and we'll get into better control to try to enhance the population. But in the meanwhile, there were restrictions on hunting opportunity by virtue of the season, by virtue of permits, and I can't remember exactly if and to what extent permits were applied in the McGrath area. And I think there was a prohibition, Tom Paragai probably would remember, prohibition on non-resident uses. That's a different element, you know. of restricting non-residents as which aren't covered, whose rights are not protected under the Constitution. The common use and equal protection applies to Alaskan residents, not to the world. So that's a useful tool that has been used in many cases, actually, in regulation to moderate the level of harvest of some particular resource that may be of concern.
Oh, explain that a little bit more to me. So in the McGrath area, if you have a low moose population, what I hear you saying is that Fish and Game has allowed moose permits for that area, but that doesn't just include people who live there. Someone could fly into McGrath and get a permit and hunt moose, right?
That's correct, yeah. What was your comment?
The Board of Game does this.
Oh, yeah.
Not the
distinction. Fish and Game may propose it.
I meant
to go into effect as a regulation has to go to the Board of Game.
So I don't know how much of it is hypothetical and how much of it is real, but if you have a resource shortage, the question is, should local people have first access to that resource based on need? Or following the common use provision, and should it be available to anyone to have access?
One of the things that you hit, you said, based on need, there is nothing in the federal priority or in a rural priority that is based on need. And if I'm not mistaken, and Richard, you might correct me, in the McDowell decision, they pointed that out. They said if there was an individual, it was based on individual need, you could design a priority. Just like you have your income tax is based on need. People that make a lot more money pay a lot more tax, and people who don't make much money don't pay much tax. But this was a priority based on territory, and territorial priorities didn't pass muster.
Wasn't there a discussion about making it need-based, and that proved very difficult to how do you define and prove need?
Yes, there was a lot of discussion about that. And that brings up another side issue. Several governors, I'll just mention this as quickly as I can, three governors that I can remember attempted to get the Constitution of the state amended to include a rural priority. Walter Hickel was not one of them. He chose to try to get the law rewritten so that it better accommodated subsistence uses in harmony, more or less, with other uses. And so he established an advisory commission on subsistence, and I had the good fortune to have served on that as well. And one of the things that came up in there, we talked a lot about need in that. Eventually, that advisory council recommended the contents of a bill to Hickel that was worked over and eventually went to the legislature, and first it was rejected, later it got passed in a modified form. But we talked about need a lot. And the objection that came up, and it came principally from AFN, but some other similar interest, was need pervades the notion of welfare and dependence and inability to support oneself. And that's demeaning. We don't want need in there. We don't want need in there. Need reflects badly on the people to whom the priority would apply were it based on need. So it was really interesting because we talked about, okay, if you're going to set some standards, what could they be? We talked about seasonal use, a variety of seasonal uses, levels of harvest of resources, and so on and so forth. And it was very interesting because I said, well, you know, if you want a simple, easy standard, just take, look in my freezer. 90% of what's in my freezer is wild game and fish. Take that as a standard. And Mitch and Minif in particular objected to that, and they said, that's too high. We don't want that kind of a priority. And yet what that reflected was need or level of use, reliance on the resource. Well, it turns out there were no standards of that sort established in the context of that proposed bill. But I was really kind of surprised, you know. It wasn't the objection to the popular perception of need that might occur was much stronger than I anticipated. I did not think there would be that kind of an objection. But it related to this business of diminishing the recipient's stature in the public eye, or maybe in society, and maybe in the native eyes, I don't know.
But with your history of experience in rural Alaska, what was your position on that?
What was what?
What was your position on that? I mean...
On need?
Yeah.
I would,
need is a criteria.
Yeah. I would have been...
A legitimate criteria.
Yeah. I would have been willing to, and I think I would have supported the idea of need if there were some standards that were practical and enforceable. And that gets very difficult. I mean, I said, look in my freezer. Well, you know, it's kind of crazy to think somebody's going to be running around town looking in everybody's freezer. So that there are some real obstacles to that. But one of the alternatives that was proposed was that it be based on culture. And if there's anything that is more amorphous than the limits and interpretation of culture, I don't know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So that was not a criterion that I felt. I really strongly opposed that because I just felt that would be an impossible thing to set any sort of standards that could be regularly legislated, coded, and enforced. It's, let me draw a parallel. It's kind of like in state law, there's a rule against going across state land with a vehicle if you cause damage to the surface. But I don't think there's any definition of what damage to the surface is. And it's the same sort of ambiguity. As a result, there's practically no restriction of that sort of thing unless it's really substantial on state lands.
This goes back to Hammond's favorite quote.
Oh. People recognizing subsistence.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, good cue. Hammond was a... Go ahead if you have a question. Hammond's quote. Get the dog.
Oh.
Our dog is intervening with his toy.
Yeah, his squeaky
was
toy.
Favorite quote?
Well, I don't know if it was his favorite one. He had so many good ones, I'm not sure this was a favorite. But in the midst of the whole subsistence discussion, he said, subsistence is like pornography. No one can define it, but anyone can recognize it when they see it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think, Tom, you had a question. Why don't you go ahead and pose it?
I'm sorry?
I'm not, it's a question. It's just that the discussion has been about how need is defined when game stocks are low. And I just wanted to point out that the state has tier two hunts when there are more people that want to hunt in an area than a allowable level of harvest there. And so you, when you apply for that, you talk about how many years you've actually hunted in that particular population, how many years you've lived in what community, and then they also look at the cost of fuel and groceries and stuff. And based on that scoring, that's how state resident allocation is done for these tier two hunts when there's less available than can support harvest by residents. That's the way that the state allocates, and that can work anywhere in the state. It can work on the road system, or it can work in a remote area.
Thank you for that clarification.
Yeah, thanks, Tom, for filling in that detail. I thought of that, but I just kind of left that restricting participation by various means that didn't preclude participation from other people in local.
I think we probably should move to the last category, and then we have some time for other people's questions if they have them. And that is the predator-prey, the history of that predator-prey issue that you got involved with early on, and how that developed.
I'm sure glad you saved an easy one for last. Yes, it is. And it's been with us humans for a long time. But so just to point out that predator control of one fashion or another has been used in the country ever since it's been a country almost. And it's been really interesting. And I'll jump to when I was in school and point out that at that time, and this would be the late 50s, early 60s, it was very popular among teachers and students. What was very popular was the notion that predation did not limit or eliminate prey populations. And it really was kind of gospel at the time that I was in graduate school here at the university. And as a matter of fact, as you probably know, the federal government did extensive wolf control prior to statehood. They continued to do a little bit on reindeer ranges and so on after statehood. When the state took over, a number of the biologists, some of whom were veterans of federal service, took strong issue with the federal control programs and with the principle of predator control, and just raised holy hell with the remaining federal programs that existed and the people who had run the previous ones. There were some pretty hot arguments. So among ADF&G, there were some real apostles of getting rid of the bounty. And one of the proposals also which came to pass was classifying wolves as both fur bearers and big game animals, removing the bounty not only on wolves but on seals and wolverines and so on. Prior to statehood, there was even a permit provision where trappers could get a permit to trap out of season. One of the guys I interviewed at Minchuna had done that, Leonard Mankey. Augmented his income. Anyway, so fishing game folks, when I was just a grunt in the lab, were really out on the trail of upgrading the status of the wolf. And the bounty was removed eventually. and it was reclassified as, wolves were reclassified as dual fur bears and big game. And by and large, predator control programs ceased to exist for a while. In the course of monitoring moose populations, it became apparent there's some real variations in characteristics of them in terms of survival of the calf crop and various other things. And at the time, I was working on moose data from around the state, and the war was still going on about upgrading the status of the wolf. And I mentioned to my boss, who was in charge of moose studies, that it was an interesting coincidence that in those areas where calf survival of moose was extremely low, too low to sustain the population, anecdotal evidence indicated that wolf numbers were very high. And you have to picture it, right in the heat of battle over removing the bounty and upgrading the status of the wolf. And this twerp from the back lab comes up with this idea that there's an interesting coincidence between lack of calves and abundance of wolves. My boss says to me, "For God's sakes, don't tell the public that." I just cracked up. But you know, people were really stuck. Fish and Game was really stuck in between imperatives or preferences in management. Another one was cow moose hunting. At that very same time, there were
Do we freeze up?
Yeah, Dick froze up. Let's see if we can get him back. I mean, he's still there, but their internet must have done something. I don't know. Dick, can you hear us? And know that you've frozen up. We can't hear you. He may have to log out and log back in, but I don't know how to communicate that to him. Oh, okay. The bishops just logged off, so maybe they're going to log back in to reset themselves. So we will wait a second. And Roger has disappeared too, so I don't know if that was an internet issue or a time factor or what. He's dropped out.
But yeah, if Roger's called in from home, that means he's in the Goldstream Valley also.
Right. Yeah, I don't know if he was at home or at the office. Maybe it's just a sign that we've talked too long.
Well, I wanted to give Tom and Roger a chance and you a chance, Karen, to ask anything that you might want to.
Well, let's see if we can get them back. I was thinking some of the outdoor council stuff.
Yeah.
And that I set up another interview with them, because it's, you know, an hour and a half we've gone now, and do that as a separate topic so that we can have more time for more detail.
Do you want to call them, or do you?
I don't have their phone number.
Tom, do you want to send him an email?
Well, Roger's back.
I'll shoot them an email.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm assuming they are fiddling with it and trying to get back on. So they are using an iPad, which may be, I've never used, but it might have some different issues. I know that if you hit it just right, it does weird things. So, Let's see if they're trying to...
My connection's been going off and on, so I've been kind of in and out.
Yeah, that's what we figured is why you were, Roger, why you were disappearing, coming and going.
I'll tell you, Dick reminds me of Jay Hammond when I look at him and listen to him in a lot of ways. You know that?
Same style, yeah.
So, Roger, did you have any particular questions that you want to ask if we get the bishops back?
Not really, other than I'd be interested in hearing more about his trapping time and citizens living at Minchumina, Fabian Carey and that connection. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you want to go to that, and it's not as politically valuable, but it's kind of a fascinating realm that Tom and I talked to him about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was thinking, too, some of the life out in Goldstream Valley, the homestead stuff was, you know, there's more we could get into on details on all of the topics, you know, the subsistence issues and priorities and the politics and some more of their stories from D.C. and things and who he worked with at Fish and Game and all that. I think there's more to detail we can go into.
Is that the
one? I'm going to go. That's my landline. I'm going to go check it. Hold on a sec. And the recording back on just for this last little...
So let's maybe finish up this predator prey question, and last I heard cow moose were being taken by wolves, and the question came up: isn't there a connection between predator and prey?
Yeah, well, things went on, and more information was gathered, and finally it was obvious that some more study was needed, and Bill Gassaway really got after it with a classic test the hypothesis type scientific set of objectives to examine the question of to what extent can predation limit moose populations. And make a long story short, Tom can add to it if he wishes, and he's much more familiar with it than I. But yes, it turns out it can and do. And as a result, the Fish and Game began to change perspective from no predation is of no effect to needing to manage predator populations in some cases to allow either the population to be assured of sustainability or to provide, in addition to that, for human uses. Then we got an intensive management law in the state legislature that compelled, I guess is the right word, the Board of Game to establish a priority for human use in some areas where appropriate, and in those areas, intensive management of predators, be it wolves or bears, could be planned and implemented. So that's where things are now, and so there have been several predator management programs on the state over a number of years, and the latest maybe prominent example is that the 40-mile caribou herd really recovered from wolf management, and now it's bumping its top limit. One of the elements of that recovery, however, that's seldom mentioned by the department is that a private group, when predator control was anticipated, took somewhere around 200 wolves by trapping out of that area at the very outset of the effort to get the herd to recover. So that was a form of control also, but it was not one that was done or demanded or requested by the Department of Fish and Game. It was a citizens' initiative. It was very effective in removing wolves. And in my view, it probably contributed to accelerating the recovery of the 40-mile caribou. But anyway, That's kind of, so now, you know, from the department's perspective, Tom, correct me if I'm wrong, there are times and places where predator control, be it wolves or bears, is determined to be the appropriate management technique in order to either, number one, sustain populations and or to increase the opportunity for human use in those areas where human use is most important.
Is there an example of something that didn't work down by with caribou in some Aleutian island where the Park Service said you can't take, and the caribou was caribou were endangered. There was only a few left in the herd.
I haven't heard the rest of the story on that, but on one of the refuges, there was caribou that was declining. Fish and Game proposed to control the number of wolves to ensure that the caribou population thrived. The Fish and Wildlife Service said, no, you can't come on the refuge and do that. And the last I heard, it was still a standoff. I don't know what became of that. Tom probably knows.
Yeah, I think that probably the situation you're thinking of is the Unimak caribou herd, which is just across False Pass from the Cold Bay area. The board authorized a program there, and the state was going to go out and conduct the control, and the federal government said that they would arrest the state agents if they went out there and did it. So that one never actually occurred. And the Southern Alaska Peninsula control program is an interesting one because that's the one where the wolf pups were euthanized with carbon monoxide in a couple of dens 1 year, and it's still referred to as gassing the wolf pups. But the reason that was done by the state is because the time of year when the public could possibly do aerial shooting of wolves down there, they're all on federal lands, and so it was only in the springtime they were denning on state lands outside the refuge when the state agents get in there at the dens and do the control work. And they had a very strong numeric response by the caribou. They were getting down to fairly low numbers. The harvest had actually been stopped on them. And that amount of basically wolf control for two years, I believe, in 2007, 2008, and that herd fairly rapidly recovered from that, not to great numbers, but at least they can support a small harvest out there by local folks at this point.
Thanks, Tom.
And so the, oops, I'm on mute. So the whole idea of all of this predator control is when you're managing a herd for human consumption to make sure there are enough animals to sustain a hunt. Is that correct?
Well, that's not the whole idea because like that caribou population that Tom just described, there was a serious concern about whether it might be extirpated if wolf numbers were not reduced or eliminated. And there was a study in southeastern Alaska on predator-prey relations between deer and wolves. I can't remember the island's name. It might have been Kuprinoff, but I'm not sure that it was. Anyway, the point is, it wasn't a very big island. There were deer and wolves there. The wolves increased, and short story is they cleaned out the deer, and that was the end of it.
Oh yeah. It wasn't Coronation Island?
Could have been. I've forgotten the name.
I know Dave Klein mentioned that same study and situation to me. I can't remember.
He was very much up on that.
Yeah, I don't remember, but it sounds familiar.
Ned Rozell did a story in the paper about that.
Yeah.
I think incorporating Dave's comments.
Yeah, probably. On the intensive management program you mentioned, that's been set up in various places in Alaska, and as you mentioned, the 40-mile herd is one of that. Is that something that's set up by the Board of Game or by the department?
It has to be approved by the Board of Game. It's planned and either recommended either for or against by the Department of Fish and Game. But ultimately, if it's going to be implemented, it has to be done under regulations passed by the Board of Game.
Okay. but the
Roger, Tom, any more questions? Karen, did you have something you wanted to say?
Well, yeah, so on the intensive management, as you said, it's not every herd in the, or every place in the state. It's applied to certain locations. So who determines where that intensive management should get utilized or not? And the board makes the final decision, but does the department say, oh, we would like to do this in place A or place B?
Well, the Board of Game makes the decision. The department may and certainly has the responsibility to give the board the facts and an opinion on what the facts are about, and probably a recommendation, whether it's the facts support the notion of intensive management in that particular area for that particular big game population. So I suppose in a sense the department is consulting, I suppose you could say, but they do have the responsibility to have the data and give it to the board and give their interpretation of it.
Mm-hmm. And I would imagine that advisory councils also come in to play there if they want it or don't want it.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
And McGrath.
They probably would, you know, advisory committees would normally comment on proposals of that sort and other
and
proposals, of course.
Right. Now, so were you involved in any of those intensive management proposals to say the department suggests we do that in some place?
No, I don't think I was, because I think that evolved after I retired. We did a lot of wolf management planning before I retired. A lot of that kind of got held up, and we also did some wolf control during that time. But it was prior to, I believe, the intensive management law passing, and it also was during a period when it was very difficult for the department to implement wolf control because during the Knowles administration, the governor and his advisors squelched initiatives on predator management.
Yeah, that's an important thing that Dick just mentioned on here, is that intensive management, the history of it involves separation of powers, and the legislature passed that law in 1994, but during the Knowles administration, Governor Knowles and Commissioner Frank Rue did not approve any lethal wolf control, even though the board passed several intensive management plans authorizing them. There was no lethal control until Governor Murkowski came to office. So that's an important point to make. The law was passed, but the executive branch has the ability to not enforce what the board does. So that's part of the check and balance in state government.
Maybe that's why Richard was grinding his teeth so much.
Where are we, Karen?
I would like...
Go ahead, Mary.
Okay, I would like to bring up one other thing.
Can I get on here?
I'll just move this over here. I'm okay. Fine. In 1983, the Alaska Outdoor Council reorganized and actually took on the name Alaska Outdoor Council. It had been in existence as the Alaska Sportsmen's Council since roughly 1955. When it reorganized, a couple of the local board members were Sam Harbo, whom you probably have heard of, and Lyle Carlson, who is a local attorney, and Bud Burris. They were board members, and I was the the editor for the quarterly newsletter. And I guess I can show this. The Alaska Outdoors in Alaska was a newsletter that went out. Here's an old, a newer one, from 1983 to 1990 that I was the editor of it. And it's a, what do they call it? This style of paper, it's tabloid. It was printed by commercial printing here. I had a lot of help technically with it from Dick Burley. And it covers, the stories in it cover the history of all of this stuff, whether it be the subsistence priority, which unfortunately the Outdoor Council was always said it was against the opposed subsistence. Then, of course, they did not oppose subsistence. They opposed the priority. And but the people out in Bush, Alaska, often thought that the Outdoor Council opposed subsistence. And so some people actually thought we were animal rights type people. And we met some of them as they were students on campus who just were absolutely positive we were opposed to all hunting because we were opposed to subsistence. They didn't recognize that our opposition was to the nature of the priority. Anyway, all of this stuff is documented in this newsletter, and the newsletter is digitally has been put on, what is it called, digitally?
Yeah.
And is available through the current president of the Alaska Outdoor Council, and it's immense files, so we can't handle them here. And he actually has to go to someplace else to send them. But it documents a lot of the subsistence uproar, a lot of the predator-prey uproar, a lot of the beginnings of the sovereignty issue, navigable waters, all kinds of issues. Court cases, the McDowell case, all kinds of this stuff. And I'm hoping that it is at the university archives. And if it isn't, please let me know and I'll do what I can to get it there.
Mary, we need you to give me the name of that publication again, the complete name.
The original was called Out of Doors in Alaska. Out of Doors in Alaska. I think that it was pretty much always Out of Doors in Alaska. Official publication of the Alaska Fish and Wildlife Federation and Outdoor Council and the Alaska Fish and Wildlife Conservation Fund. Those are the two formal IRS names of the organizations. They're sister 501c3 and 501c4 organizations.
And what is the name of the current president who we would contact about that?
Bill Iverson, and he lives in Soldotna.
Okay. Website?
And then the website would be under Alaska Outdoor Council.
Okay.
And his contact would be listed there.
Okay, great. I can check with the Rasmussen Library and see if they have it.
I think I had it mailed to it, but I don't know. See, I was the editor from 83 to roughly 90, and then there was various editors since then.
Okay.
Karen?
Yeah.
I have the name of the other two people who qualified as guides in Nikolai.
Oh, okay.
One is Gleeman, spelled G-L-E-E-M-A-N, Esai, E-S-A-I, and the second one is Nick, N-I-C-K, Dennis, D-E-N-N-I-S.
Okay, great.
Did Ray Collins help in that effort too?
Mary asked me if Ray Collins of McGrath had helped with that, and I think he did peripherally, but not directly in...
He lived in Nikolai at that time. Yes.
Probably, yeah. Ray Collins is a family who lived in Nikolai for years, as you probably know, and I'm sure he expedited it.
Mm-hmm.
And the other person who was of considerable help was Terry Dickey, who was a VISTA volunteer in Nikolai at the time. And much later, I don't know what he did in between, but he wound up being at the UAF Museum for quite a long time.
Yeah, I know him from the museum. I didn't know he'd been a VISTA volunteer out there. That's a neat connection.
Yeah. Yeah, he was very helpful. We really worked together closely to figure out how to make it possible for these guys to take advantage of the knowledge they possessed and qualify for something that was not geared to the way they normally communicated, is the way to put it amounted to.
Mm-hmm.
That's a neat story. Now, Dick, you left the Alaska Outdoor Council, is that correct, in 89?
That's correct.
No, not in 89.
Yes. I left the Department of Fish and Game in 89.
When did you leave
I haven't left it, but I spent roughly the next 20 years. I was with Fish and Game a little over 20 years. After I retired, I spent virtually the next 20 years in various capacities with the Alaska Outdoor Council, ranging from executive director to president to board member to lobbyist. And I had the satisfaction of being the AOC lobbyist in Juneau at the time, the last time that Knowles tried to run a rural priority constitutional amendment through, and it failed. And a friend of mine who had been on the other side of the issue for decades gave me the greatest compliment. He said, "Well, Dick, looks like you won this time." I said, "Thank you, Don." Because the effort to amend the Constitution had failed.
And now there's not even any effort to do it. And evidently, we hear that there's some question that whether AFN even wants it to be amended.
Well, AFN since has said that we're just going to try to make the best of the federal management. We're wasting our time with the state. Which is true, because the state is bound by common use and equal protection. And the extent of the preference that they would like is impermissible under that standard. It goes. I think the legislature, nobody in the legislature wanted to deal with the subsistence issue again. It was so controversial, so contentious. Senator Click Bishop had a great story about it. His name and mine, last names are the same. We're no direct relation anywhere that we know of. He got elected to the legislature, and he went around to introduce himself to various people, and he went into Senator Lyman Hoffman's office to make an appointment, and he couldn't get one. He kept going back, trying to get something set up, Finally, somebody told Hoffman that Click Bishop was no relation to Dick Bishop, and it was okay to meet with him. So Lyman Hoffman had, we didn't get along. And he was unforgiving.
But the effort now, as I understand it, is more for, you could say, priority use or special use is more through the Federal Subsistence Board system.
That's right. Federal Subsistence Board and federal policies. You're probably out of time, so we could go on.
Yeah, well, we were...
I think we should stop now because we've gone 2 hours and it's better to think about these things and come back and ask more about it than to keep going, I think. But thank you for your generosity. I mean, you've been very generous in sharing information and educating us on these issues. And Mary, if you would send those references you mentioned earlier today, that would be great.
With regard to only in times of shortage?
The laws. You were talking about some of the laws and things.
Yes. It's just a legal-sized sheet of paper.
That's fine. It's great.
Made succinct.
Excellent.
And who do I send to?
Well, I'm particularly interested, but I think Karen would be interested too, and okay. I don't know about Tom and Rob.
Are you going to send it by email? Are you going to send it by email or by regular mail?
Email.
Oh, just send it to all of us by email.
Just put an attachment.
Yeah.
Okay, and I should have all your emails.
You should have all of them, yeah. So two matters of business that we'll talk about maybe by email, a time to schedule another interview, if you guys would be up for it, to talk about some more of this stuff and in more detail. Like the Outdoor Council, I'm particularly interested in hearing more about when you're not tired at the end of 2 hours and how you would feel about...
Yes.
How you would feel about doing another interview at a later date.
Well, I'd be fine with it.
Okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That'd be great. And then the other paperwork thing is that because we recorded this and we want to put it in the archive, we have release agreement forms for everybody to sign. And if we were in person, we'd just have you do it right there. So I think the best approach will be that I'm going to email you a blank one. If you can print it out and sign it and then just stick it in the postal mail back to me.
That should work.
Okay, because the other thing, Tom and Roger, if they want to scan it, sign it and scan it and email it, they can do that. But I don't think for you guys the easiest is just stick it in the mail.
Yeah. I
will send you the form and the address to send it to.
Okay. Thank you very much Karen and Bill and for setting this up and bearing with us. And Tom, I really appreciate your chiming in because obviously I don't remember everything. Hopefully what I remember correctly, but I know I don't remember everything.
And will somebody check to see if they've got, if they have this... Outdoors in Alaska?
Yeah, I'll check with Rasmussen Library in the archives and see if they have it, and if not, I'll let you and the current president know and get you in touch with the right people.
Good, thank you.
Because I'm interested in looking at it. It sounds really interesting, so it's great that it's digital. And I appreciate you guys...
It took the lady who I sent all these copies to evidently 2 weeks to scan them all.
that's good. And I just wanted to thank you, Mary, and Dick for sticking with us and all this technology and learning all of it and doing a test yesterday and trying to get your faces in the screen at the right place and all that. And I wish we could meet in person.
We will sometime.
Someday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really appreciate listening in here. As you know, wildlife management is a large degree people management. And there's a lot of this history that I'm trying to learn. A lot of the younger folks have no clue about this, and I've been trying to scan old documents from the 1950s and 60s about some of these various issues and making it available in our fish and game library for people and try to refer back to it. So I really appreciate learning the history of some of this.
And this is where I give the plug for Dave Klein's book.
Oh, yes, good.
Where do we get it?
UA Press Online or Amazon Online, either of those options.
Okay. That's what I figured, but I thought it Yeah,
and, or if you have trouble
is
with...
Is it available at the Wien Library?
I'm sure.
Should be.
Okay. Should be.
Good.
I know it's available at Rasmussen Library, so it should be at Wien. And if you have any trouble, you know, either getting it at the library or ordering one, just let me know and I can get you a copy. Mm-hmm. So that's
great.
Not a problem. I'm going to stop the recording, so you're going to hear...
The recording has stopped.